Chapter 68. Within a month of their first secret meeting with Vi, the chattel had dreamt up 24 new spells. A gap-toothed farm wife with tobacco-stained teeth knew a spell that made food more filling. An Alateran widow had developed a weave to keep food fresh for months. Others added their knowledge, and soon they'd created biscuits half the size of a man's hand that would give him energy for the whole day, made him feel satisfied, and came in 12 flavors. A village blacksmith's wife had crafted a spell that kept plows sharp, and it was easily applied to swords, but it had to be reapplied every day. Almost all the women had some experience as healers, so they crafted bandages that stayed cleaner longer, packable spider webs to help blood clot instantly, potent salves for burns, poultices that could suck poison out of wounds. One could bond a simple repelling spell to fabric, making light tents or tunics stay dry even in a storm. A cowherd taught them a spell to firm treacherous, muddy roads. It would dissipate almost instantly, but if the Magi spaced themselves along a column, an entire army could march safely through a bog. Few of them could throw a fireball, but when a soft-spoken woman told Vi that she had crafted a spell-containing spell, they had something better. One woman would cast a spell container, another would cast a simple fire spell, and a third would bind it to an arrow. The spell was smaller than a woman's fist, but the arrows wouldn't fly well until someone figured out how to smooth the spell over the entire length of the shaft. Then the arrow flew true, struck the practice dummy's shield, and the spell container burst, splashing fire over the shield and the dummy. The dummy was engulfed in fire in seconds. Magi around the yard stopped what they were doing and turned to watch. Several of the herders knew spells that would temporarily sharpen sight, hearing, or smell. Working together, they made one spell that was more efficient than any of the three alone that would last the duration of a watch. It could be applied to sentries or scouts. Then they took to reversing their spells. An enemy's food could be spoiled in a day. Making roads muddy was harder than making them dry, however, as a major had to soften many layers of earth rather than harden a few. Likewise, dulling the enemy's weapons during a battle was deemed impossible. Magically locating hundreds or thousands of moving swords and differentiating friends from foes was too difficult. They could make wounds fester and suppurate and attract flies, but most of the women were too sickened for such work. Those who had trained as healers, who would have been best suited to it, said their vows precluded it. The two fronts where they made no progress at all were the signal sticks and magically representing a battle. Gareth or Sewell had been able to see a battlefield and communicate instantly with his generals or men across his kingdom. In war, signal banners could be missed or captured or out of the line of sight. Trumpets' calls could be lost in the cacophony, and with either of those, the messages passed were both necessarily simple: withdraw, advance, come now, and public. Developing signal sticks would mean giving commanders the ability to hear scouts report from behind enemy lines, rather than hoping that they could cross back over and report hours or days later. It would mean ordering cavalry to reinforce a wavering line and having them move instantly, rather than minutes later. It would mean a general could split his armies and still coordinate their movements, or change their strategy as the situation changed, rather than being committed to meet on a specific day at a certain area and hope nothing kept the other half of your army away from getting there. The failure put Vi in an evil mood, which wasn't helped when Sister Ariel laughed at her. "Vi," she said, joining her on the field, "don't you see what you've accomplished?" Vi grunted. "I've made war easier." Well, yes, you have, but you've done something more remarkable. Remarkable for any major, but perhaps doubly so for you.
What's that?
Vi asked, suspicious of any praise from Sister Ariel. You're teaching these women to wage war without trying to be men. The simple fact is, most women aren't really good at throwing fire or calling down lightning. If you'd insisted on these women becoming war magi as the Chantry thought of war magi, they'd have made little progress before spring. Instead, you've let them be who they are. It's common sense. By the Seraph's Titsvi, Magus's fireball isn't any good if he can't cross a bog to get to the battle. His lightning bolt can't hurt anyone if he starves. We were right about you. It might be common sense, but the weaves you've encouraged these women to develop would never have been encouraged by anyone else. You want to know why? Because we all have blind spots, Vi, even you. The good thing is that yours are different from ours. Your common sense answer violates one of our institutional creeds in place since the Third Alatiran Accord, which is that the sisterhood is complete. By abandoning certain areas of study, many would say you imply that men are better at those types of magic. That statement would be enough to paralyze most sisters from doing the work you're doing. Even if they agreed it was true, they would spend a lot of energy trying to conceal the fact that they weren't studying fire and lightning and earthquakes.
I'm not making any statements, Vi said.
I bet I can throw a better fireball than most magi, and I haven't even worked on it. I'm just trying to save our asses.
Oh.
Just because a crisis threatens to wipe us out, you think we should stop infighting? Vi scrunched her eyebrows together.
Is that a real question?
Sister Ariel laughed.
How are things, on the conjugal front?
What?
Right when Vi thought Sister Ariel was being kind, the woman had to pull out her big words to make Vi feel stupid.
How are things with your husband?
Sister Ariel asked, after making sure no one was close enough to overhear. At even the mention of him, Vi felt Kylar, only 50 paces away, training in the basement of their manse with Durzo. He seemed happy despite his many bruises. Vi healed them secretly from time to time when Kylar was asleep in the mornings. The last month had been awkward, but not nearly as bad as Vi had feared. Vi had expected to feel malice leaking through the bond at all times, and if Kylar had hated her, there was no way she could be anything but miserable. Mostly, though, he didn't think about her. She was training and studying as many hours a day as her body could stand, and so was he. When she got home, she went to bed immediately. Meanwhile, Kylar and Aline had found a pater to marry them in secret. Durzo, Uli, Sister Ariel, and Vi were the only witnesses. Kylar had moved into Aline's room, though consummating their marriage was impossible, and any time cuddling even flirted with the erotic, Kylar began to get sick. Oddly, they still had that newlywed glow. Maybe it was all intensified because they knew Aline didn't have much time left, so they touched whenever they could, though carefully, and spent hours talking. Vi knew Kylar felt the absence of sex acutely. Some nights she'd lie awake on the opposite side of the wall from where he lay awake. Aline snuggled into his chest. She could feel the ache of desire. But as soon as he entertained the desire, his thoughts veered to Vi, and with an iron self-control, he stopped those thoughts and began admiring everything he loved about Aline. Sometimes, Vi knew, that iron self-control was rusted all the way through, but still he closed the door. They'd met twice in their dreams.
You don't hate me,
Vi said in the first dream. She marveled at it.
I hate the price we have to pay. Can you forgive me? she asked.
I'm trying.
You did what had to be done. You're not a bad woman, Vi. I know that you've been giving me and Aline space and time, and I know it's hard for you, too.
Thank you.
He glanced down at her nightdress, this one actually fit, and his gaze was admiring, but deliberately brief.
I just wish you weren't so damn beautiful.
Good night. The second dream had been harder. It had been one of those nights where Kylar lay on the opposite side of the wall so tormented he thought he would burst. In the dream, Kylar stood at the foot of Vi's bed, naked. His eyes were closed, and Vi drank in the sight of him, his hard, lean limbs, flat stomach etched with hard muscles. She was wearing one of Master Pekun's nightdresses, which she'd left behind in Cenaria. It was white silk and short with sheer panels, but more pretty than provocative. A make love to me, not a fuck me. It was one of the first things she'd ever bought from Master Pekun, and in 4 years, she'd never worn it. Men made love to their wives or girlfriends. Vi got fucked. Her hair was unbound and combed out glossy. Vi had a revelation at the very moment Kylar opened his eyes. Kylar had never seen this dress. This wasn't his dream. It was hers. She froze, feeling more exposed than she had when she'd stood naked in front of the God King. Gareth or Sul had judged her, not knowing her. Kylar had far more power. He was here because she desired him. Vi had long been the object of desire, and she'd mocked men for it. Now, the numbness that had sat between her legs since the first time one of her mother's lovers raped her was thawing. The ache there was so foreign that Vi hadn't been able to name it. For all the fucking she'd done, Vi had not once taken a man to bed for pleasure, much less love. The receding numbness, though, not only allowed her to feel desire for the first time, it also threatened her. Through the ice, Vi could see the outlines of a mystery. She could imagine bringing her desire, of which fucking was a part but not the center, to Kylar and experiencing union, wholeness in a fragmented world. She'd made fucking a simple physical exertion, as monotonous but as necessary to her work as exercising. If she ever wanted to experience what was beneath the ice, she'd have to feel the pain and violation frozen inside it. If Kylar were to speak while they had sex, she'd remember all the bastards who couldn't shut up. If he were to remain silent, she'd remember the brutes who fucked silently. If Kylar were to twine his fingers through her hair, she'd remember all the assholes who pawed her hair like she was an animal. If Kylar ripped her clothes off in his passion, she would remember when Hugh Gibbet did it and spat on her face. If Vi were ever to enjoy Kylar's desire and allow herself to reciprocate, she'd have to trust him with her brokenness, and she'd have to wade through all the hells her numbness had spared her. She understood all of that in the very moment Kylar's opening eyes met hers. She tensed, and immediately her hair was back up in its ponytail, tight enough to hurt. Two waves of feeling raced through Kylar, the second chasing the first, and even with her emotional stupidity, or however Sister Ariel had said it, Vi could name his feelings through the very air. The first was desire, and though it was physical, it wasn't only physical. A month of cuddling the woman he loved had been a month of foreplay. But right after that, he withdrew.
Vi.
Kylar choked out.
I can't even be here.
He ignored his own nudity, and her near nudity, looking into her eyes and letting her read his. Her rapists had shattered the bond between sex and intimacy, leaving her only with fucking. In ring-raping Kylar, she'd left him with only intimacy. The difference was, the only person who could damage Kylar as she had been damaged long ago was Kylar himself. The integrity between what Kylar's body did and what his heart felt was still intact. He was sorely tempted, but so far, unbroken. If he cheated on Eileen, he would be a cheater in his own eyes for the rest of a very long life. He'd turned and walked out of her dream. Vi cleared her throat and met Sister Ariel's gaze. "Things with Kylar are fine,"